Thank you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument with the petitioner in Campbell versus State of Texas.
May it please the court, Mr. Leitner will present argument to the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The petitioner intends to argue orally only issues number one and issues number three. As to issue number one, which we believe is the main issue in this case, it is petitioner's position that Article 4603 of the Code of Criminal Procedure and the Texas Health and Safety Code, or what's commonly referred to as the Mental Health Code, can be read together and harmonized together without having to claim that certain provisions of the Mental Health Code are inappropriate when you're talking about individuals found not guilty by reason of insanity. We believe that it can be, and it has been for decades in this state. The only reported opinion that claims otherwise, other than this case is before the court right now, came in the case of Lopez versus the state, and that case was a case that had all kind of problems, but it was decided on the issue that they denied a jury trial to Lopez. Therefore, the statement there that the Mental Health Code did not apply was dicta, and it was not followed by any of the other reported opinions throughout the state. Weller versus State was a case that decided strictly on point with the issue in this case, and that is, once someone is found not guilty by reason of insanity, and they're up for a recommitment to the mental hospital, that you have to follow the Mental Health Code. And one of the provisions of the Mental Health Code was is that not at the time that a motion by whomever it is filed to have them recommitted, but before the hearing takes place, there has to be on file two certificates of medical examination that say that the individual has been examined and that he meets the criteria for involuntary commitment.
Well, then in a nutshell, is your position that Weller is the interpretation of the statute that should be applied and in fact harmonizes 46.03 with the Mental Health Code?
That's correct.
Well, if that's the case, then let me just ask you, aren't we not imposing an additional condition precedent upon the court's obligation to hold a hearing beyond what 46.03 requires if we adopt that interpretation?
Be honest with the court, I don't understand what you're saying.
4603 requires, it's mandatory, that the court hold a hearing. There's no mandatory language if, in fact, a letter is received from the director of the facility with the recommendation in it that must be considered by the court, and then if the court on its own motion or on the motion of the district or county attorney. The hearing is mandatory under the statute.
If you want to recommit the individual, yes, the hearing
is
mandatory.
The hearing is mandatory. The court doesn't have any choice under those circumstances whether on its own motion. If we have the certificate from the director of the facility and the court decides or the district or county attorney moves for a hearing, then the hearing is mandatory.
A hearing of some sort is mandatory.
Right. And aren't we then, if we look to the Mental Health Code, to also require two certificates before holding the hearing? In fact, creating a conflict with 4603 because we've imposed an additional condition precedent before the court can actually hold the hearing.
I believe when you read the statute says the hearing has to be conducted according to the Mental Health Code, that that's exactly what it's saying.
But it says it, but it does require a hearing. And if you don't have the two certificates under the Mental Health Code, then the court doesn't hold a hearing.
That's correct.
So as a result, we would not have the hearing, and we've elevated the certificate to the level of being a condition precedent. And that's my question to you about, doesn't this create a conflict then, because it interferes with the mandatory obligation, the court actually hold the hearing by imposing an additional condition precedent before the hearing ever takes place?
If the court does not intend to recommit the individual, they don't have to hold a hearing. If they want to recommit the individual, then they have to do it in accordance with the Mental Health Code. And the Mental Health Code says the extra condition precedent. I don't see that as a conflict, Your Honor.
The Mental Health Code.
I didn't understand.
You just said if the court doesn't want to recommitment, the court doesn't have to hold a hearing.
If the court lets the year pass and doesn't do anything, there's no authority to keep holding the individual.
But the code requires the hearing, though. It says upon receipt of such certificate or upon the expiration of a commitment order, the court shall order the discharge or, on the motion, hold a hearing. So there, it does require action on the part of the court, and if there is a motion, it does require a hearing to be held.
Correct.
As opposed to just automatically discharging.
What you just read tells me that they can either discharge him, but if they don't want to discharge him, they have to have a hearing.
They must have a hearing.
That's correct.
They can't discharge, but they can't then just decide to not have a hearing and recommit. They have to have a hearing.
That's exactly
but
right.
But in fact, if you impose the requirement of a certificate, then you've got an addition condition preceding before the hearing is held.
If that's the way you read it, then that's exactly the way I read it, Your Honor. And I believe that the 4602, when you go to the first hearing that you have, where you don't have to have the application, you still have to have the certificate.
Well, but that's my next question then. When you look at the language of 574.002, it refers to an application for court-ordered mental health services. This is not an initial application. This person has already been committed. And it talks about it having to be styled in terms of a proposed patient. This is not a proposed patient. This person is already and is currently a patient. And in fact, it talks about the fact that that inpatient mental health services are being provided under 4602 for at least 60 consecutive days, so it makes no reference to 4603. So then the next question becomes, with respect to the form of the application, whether or not by its very terms it would even apply under the mental health code.
If you look at 4603D2,
okay.
It says a hearing conducted under 4603 is a civil proceeding to be conducted by the trial court in the same manner as a hearing on an application. To me, that's what that's saying is the two certificates have to be there.
But that's the actual conducting of the hearing itself. We're dealing with something that is a prerequisite to having a hearing. Because if the court does not have these applications, then it can't go forward with the hearing under the mental health code. I mean, I just see some conflicts with the statute that I understand you say that they don't have a conflict. I see some conflicts, and I'm trying to get them reconciled and asking you to help me.
Well, obviously, the 14th Court of Appeals saw the same conflicts. In all of the other opinions that are before this court, they've always followed the mental health code, you know, that says that you have to have that requirement. And if you look at what trying to determine what the intent of the legislature was, look to the last action of the legislature when it now says that a person in Nathan Campbell's position can be transferred to the civil court for civil commitment. Are they saying then that
that's on the trial court's discretion. The trial court can choose to maintain jurisdiction over the defendant.
But does that mean then that the individual that gets transferred with different rules applying to him, different rights that he can expect just because the court made the decision to keep his case as opposed to transferring?
It seems to me that if you look at 574 is dealing with applications for court-ordered mental health services in terms of initiating those services.
I mean, there's no doubt the mental health code was written for the purpose of trying to cover everybody.
Right.
And the Code of Criminal Procedure came and said, use the mental health code to apply this to that.
But someone who has been acquitted by reason of insanity of a violent crime stands in a very different position than someone whom the state is trying to get civilly committed for mental health services in terms of the starting point of the procedure. And so the question is, where does the mental health code kick in, it seems to me, and we have to look to the language of the statute for that. Or both statutes.
I agree with you there, Your Honor.
Because in the criminal proceeding, the defendant has in fact taken the burden of showing that he or she was not guilty by reason of insanity.
That's correct.
So in fact, we already have a finding by a judge or jury on the insanity defense.
And then he's automatically committed, which is not what happens on the civil side. But after that, they say all we hear is to recommit him thereafter have to be in accordance with the mental health code. I don't see a conflict with that by saying that to follow the guidelines of the mental health code, you have to have two doctors that say he meets the criteria. I mean, I guess the court's position is then that no doctors have to say that as far as certificates
go. But then you have a different set of standards that apply during the course of the hearing in terms of proving that the person should remain committed. There are additional requirements in the mental health code for that. Right?
Right. You have to have oral testimony that complies with those certificates.
Mr. Leitner, this hadn't been briefed, and it's really not an issue that's pertinent to the Court of Appeals. But in this case, the criminal district court retained jurisdiction.
It had to.
It has the, well, it has the option of transferring it to a civil court, or it can retain jurisdiction. In which event, if it retains jurisdiction, then it proceeds under this Code of Criminal Procedure. The jurisdictional statement that you raised and wasn't disagreed with by the state just says, well, we have a dispute at the Court of Appeals because we've got judges who disagree with each other, and you say there's a conflict among the Courts of Appeals. But our court is limited to only civil cases, and I guess I have a concern whether or not we have jurisdiction to hear this when the threshold of this decision is the criminal district court's choice to retain jurisdiction of this matter. And so I would appreciate post-submission if you would look at the significance of retaining jurisdiction by the criminal district court and its continued supervisory authority over this matter. And then the state respond to that because I have a question about whether or not we have civil jurisdiction in this matter. And I recognize you say it's got to process along according to the Health and Safety Code, but the Health and Safety Code has a lot of criminal provisions or provisions in it that it makes subject to criminal prosecution. So I'm not sure that answers my question. So if you wouldn't mind post-submission, you can go ahead and talk about the merits, but I'd like to see some briefing on the whether or not we have jurisdiction to hear this appeal.
I'll certainly do that, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Jumping quickly then to the third issue, as to the district court's power when it has continuing jurisdiction to enter the orders that it entered against Nathan Campbell. There was basically three steps. The first step was in the district court when Nathan Campbell was present, his attorney there was present, when the judge entered these orders. They were objected to by his attorneys, claiming that she did not have the power to enter orders such as you cannot have any association with females of any sort, etc. He was objected to. The judge said, I understand he may have read the law, but I want him to understand my order. I know what the law is, and I'm giving this order. She had the opportunity then to change it, but she didn't. So I'm claiming that that's not way. I'll finish that argument later.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Keating will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court. To address the first issue, this is obviously a question of statutory construction. And the beginning of wisdom in any case like that is to look at the basic principles upon which such a construction should be made. The first one, it seems to me, is that any time a statute or two statutes conflict that appear to apply to the same subject matter, the specific statute is controlling over the general statute. And then sort of above that, in terms of trying to figure out which statute should apply and what interpretation is appropriate, one has to look at what the intent of the legislature would have been in trying to give effect to the provisions of the two conflicting statutes. And in this case, it seems to me that the statutes, the Health and Safety Code and the Code of Criminal Procedure, clearly conflict. The Health and Safety Code is geared towards anybody being able to file an application to have somebody, any other person, committed. It's very broad, and understandably, there's procedural protections to protect just any person on the street from such being subjected to such kinds of hearings. There must be an application that meets the requirements of the Health and Safety Code. There must be medical certificates and medical examination that comports with the Health and Safety Code. And then if those are sufficient to have the hearing, there must be proof by clear and convincing evidence, and there are certain additional requirements that proof must meet. With the Code of Criminal Procedure, Article 4603, we're talking about a very narrow subset of the population. We're talking about people who have been necessarily found beyond a reasonable doubt to have engaged in criminal conduct. Second, they have been found by preponderance of the evidence to meet the to be criminally insane, such that they are relieved of culpability for their criminal actions.
And they're acquitted.
That's correct. They are not criminals in the sense following the acquittal, that there is no conviction. And then
they are not to be treated as a criminal defendant or someone charged with a crime or something. Doesn't the statute say they're acquitted, and then there's some significance to that attached in the statute?
That's correct. I believe, and I don't recall the exact subsection, but the effect of an acquittal is just like any other acquittal. There's no bar to... There's none of the traditional bars that a criminal conviction might cause a person. A person doesn't lose the right to vote and those sorts of things. I think that has jurisdictional consequences, too, to answer your earlier question about jurisdiction. Once there is no criminal conviction, I would suggest that this court exercise its own jurisdiction is appropriate, because that takes it out of the criminal context. Now, that doesn't mean that the procedures, the fact that it stays in a district court that happens to be trying criminal cases, that court retains jurisdiction for certain practical matters.
Except that your argument, to win on your argument, you have to say that the Code of Criminal Procedure applies. And the Code of Criminal Procedure applies because the criminal district court retained its jurisdiction. So you've got this acquittal, and you've got to say, well, it's treated as if you're not, you know, the criminal. But the criminal district court has this option when it's a serious crime that's been involved to retain jurisdiction and thus subject this individual to procedures outlined in the Code of Criminal Procedure, as opposed to being a civil commitment procedure. And you therefore argue that some of the elements of the civil procedure don't apply, meaning to affidavits. And so then it seems to me it comes full circle. You argue, well, this is a civil matter, not a criminal matter, but the criminal procedures are the ones that control, not the civil procedures that control, and therefore this judge can do what this judge did.
Right, Your Honor. I'll certainly file a post-submission brief on that particular issue. I guess my short answer at this point is that the fact that we call these procedures criminal in a quasi-criminal sense, or the fact that the procedures are governed by the Code of Criminal Procedure...
In fact, the code differentiates between a criminal commitment procedure and a civil commitment procedure.
Yes, it does. It specifically vests the trial court with the authority to transfer a case for a civil commitment. I would read that as the giving the trial court the authority to decide whether to retain jurisdiction or not for practical reasons. I mean, the more violent, the more egregious the underlying conduct, the more likely it is that the district court is going to want to retain jurisdiction. I don't think that the transfer of the label we put on the procedures necessarily has jurisdictional consequences.
Well, is it still a civil commitment if the court that tried the criminal matter maintains jurisdiction over it?
We've always treated it that way. Indeed, this court in 1998 in the state of Texas versus Roland addressed a commitment following a very egregious set of facts and addressed the issue of whether having the hearing too late deprived the court of the ability to have the hearing to begin with. So it's not without precedent that this court exercises jurisdiction in such cases.
If in fact, as the code provides, that someone who is acquitted by reason of insanity really is acquitted in the legal sense of the word, then why would it be necessary for the trial court to treat an effort to keep someone committed differently than they would in the context of any other civil commitment?
I think that the...
What I understand you're asking us to do.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the reason behind that and the reason why you would want to allow a district court trying criminal cases to retain jurisdiction is really a practical one. We're talking about people who are extremely violent. In Roland, the patient had poured gasoline on his stepfather, set him on fire, and stabbed him repeatedly. Lopez and Weller, cases we petitioners talked about this morning, both involved not guilty by reason of insanity verdicts following murder cases. The instant case is, if you're aware of the facts, it's egregious. So given that those are the factual circumstances in which these cases arise, letting the court that has seen those facts and is intimately familiar with the treatment regimen, it seems to me it's simply practical to let that trial court maintain.
And I understand the legislature's made that determination because the Code of Criminal Procedure allows that court to maintain jurisdiction. My question really goes to if that really is the case, and you say that these types of cases are a subset of civil commitment proceedings that are different than the general subset of civil commitment proceedings. My question to you is, given the fact that the code treats this as an acquittal for all purposes, why should these be treated any differently than any other civil commitment procedures, which is, I think, what Mr. Leitner is saying to us, there should be no difference, and therefore all requirements of the mental health code should be applied, including the two application requirement before hearing proceeds.
Well, I guess my answer is that you look to the language of the statute. The statute, Article 4603, provides the means by which recommitment hearings take place following an acquittal by reason of insanity. At the very beginning of 4603, Section D5, 45, the language talks about how the patient can only be discharged or released pursuant to the procedures contained in this particular subsection. And that's important. The only way an NGRI acquittee can be released is if it comports with the procedures in Article 4603. That is not the same procedure that is used in the Health and Safety Code. The Health and Safety Code has additional requirements. The Health and Safety Code requires an application. It's interesting that the Health and Safety Code, the provisions that provide for an application to trigger a commitment hearing to begin with, refer to transfers under Article 4602. Article 4602 deals with incompetency findings. And that particular provision provides that when a district court who has that kind of an incompetency finding has a transfer order to a civil court and all criminal charges are dismissed, you can treat that as an application. Well, here we don't even need an application. So that's one basis on which to read in the statutory language on which to treat them differently. Additionally,
but the trigger to that is this demarcation that the court certifies the charge has been dismissed. But that also has provisions in it that says the criminal court doesn't dismiss the charges and kind of retains sort of this jurisdiction issue again. So 4602 only works if the criminal court dismisses the charges, and once they do that, they keep them in custody, but that works as an application. But we still have that retained kind of jurisdiction problem.
That's correct. I'm not sure that my understanding has always been that the district courts, for example, in Harris County, there are district courts, some of which are trying civil cases and some of which are trying criminal cases. I'm not sure that there is a literal jurisdictional difference there. I'd have to look at the statutes and constitutional provisions on that. My understanding has been that they've simply been designated one way. It doesn't literally mean that one of the other district courts wouldn't have the authority to hear other kinds of cases. But you're right in the sense of Article 4602. A transfer doesn't take place unless the court hearing the criminal case or in which that case originated actually relinquishes that jurisdiction and transfers it over to a different court. That is the way that the procedure takes place. To go back to the statutory provisions that justify reading the two differently, under Article 4603, a recommitment hearing takes place. Well, the first thing that happens is if the superintendent of the facility certifies that someone no longer meets the criteria for commitment, the trial court has to order discharge, or it must have a hearing on its own motion or on the motion of the district or county attorney. There's no requirement for an application. It's these conditions in Article 4603 that are controlling in this specific set of circumstances. And getting back to the general principle of statutory construction, Article 4603 should therefore be controlling. Under 4603, again, the only way a person can be discharged or released is if there is a finding that they no longer meet the criteria for commitment, or if there is no application and the court just chooses on its own motion and not to have a hearing. Those are the only two ways someone can be discharged. Under the Health and Safety Code, someone can be discharged merely by a technical failure in the application or the failure of the proper certificates to be in the file. So once again, there's a clear conflict and difference in the interpretation of the statutes that shows that Article 4603 ought to be the controlling authority in this particular case.
But didn't the state attorney in this case file an application for an order to extend the, I mean, didn't the pleadings that the state filed here appeared to be tracking the civil commitment process, didn't they?
That's absolutely correct. In fact, all of the cases that I've been able to find that address this issue on appeal, the underlying procedure that was used, even in the Article 4603 context, involved the filing of applications. And I guess the point that the state is making here is that doesn't really reflect an adequate analysis of Article 4603 as the controlling statutory authority. The state definitely did precisely what you just said. The state of Texas filed an application that tracked the Health and Safety Code, I think in all of its particulars in this case.
And the statute itself says that if the prosecuting attorney does that, then the application need not be accompanied by two affidavits. They can file it without the two affidavits.
The Article 4603 doesn't really provide any detail. It just says
it doesn't say anything about it, but I'm talking about if the prosecuting attorney files an application under the civil commitment statute, there's a specific provision that says they don't have to file the two affidavits. It's only later on in this process where it says, court, you can go order the affidavits to be produced, or you can do whatever you want to, but in no event, you can't hear it until they're on file.
That's correct. If it's a county attorney or a district attorney, there is no need for a contemporaneous filing of medical certificates, or I guess it's affidavits is the proper term. 574.009 is the section that provides for mandatory release if at the time of the hearing the certificates are not on file. That's different from what the Code of Criminal Procedure
and
provides.
Is that related or not related to the criminal commitment process where the district attorney, you get the certificate to release, and on a motion of the district attorney, the court shall have a hearing on whether to release. Is that not related to those provisions that talk about if a district attorney files an application, he doesn't have to file or she doesn't have to file the affidavits?
I don't think they are related. I think the provisions that in the Health and Safety Code where a district or county attorney files an application, I think those are general provisions where an application is filed in the absence of a not guilty by reason of insanity finding. This is what happens when somebody, say for example, the police find somebody on the street who appears to meet the criteria for commitment. They take him in on a mental health warrant, and then the county attorney subsequently files an application with a court for mandatory extended court-ordered mental health services. In that kind of a situation, there's the procedures in the Health and Safety Code that apply, and in that kind of a situation, there would have to be certificates on file at the time of the hearing. That's different than what happens in the case of a not guilty by reason of insanity finding. And that really, it makes sense if you think about it. A person who's been found not guilty by reason of insanity has typically provided the proof of their own mental illness at trial. They've also necessarily been found to engage in violent conduct. We wouldn't even be in Article 4603. So the level of need for the protection in the Health and Safety Code simply isn't there following a finding of not guilty by reason of insanity. The full-blown hearing or the full-blown trial on the merits really functions and it fleshes out those cases where somebody wouldn't meet the threshold requirements for commitment. So that's really where the separation comes in dealing with these two different related but different subsets of individuals.
Is that would that be the reason why 46.02 is different than 46.03? In 02, that's the incapable of providing a defense, so you can't really proceed on the case. Is that why those two are treated differently? In one case, you've actually tried, I guess, the evidence of guilt or innocence. In the other case, you've not even gone to trial on it.
Right.
In Article, am I not right?
That's essentially correct, Your Honor. 4602 deals with people who are incompetent to stand trial. That means they are either unable to understand the proceedings or unable to assist in their own defense. Now, 4602 provides a number of different ways in which a person can be committed. One, if there's a finding that they are incompetent but likely to regain their competence following a reasonable period of treatment, the court simply commits them, they come back, and if they're competent, the trial proceeds as just as if nothing had happened. Now, the difference comes when someone, under 4602, when someone is found incompetent but not likely to recover. At that point, there's basically two options. If the charges are not dismissed, that court ends up being the court in which the hearings happen. If charges are dismissed, it's like we were talking about just a moment ago, 4602 provides for the transfer to a different court to be dealt with specifically only under the provisions of the Health and Safety Code. I hope that addressed your question. This issue of statutory construction is important in the sense that, and I wanted to reiterate this, we are talking about the state of Texas' interest in protecting society from its most dangerous members. There is no question that the individuals, just look at the cases in which these issues come up, pose a great threat. The legislature sensibly created a scheme in which the court that handled these cases originally would maintain jurisdiction and created a procedure by which we can deal with them and release them only on a finding in that court that they no longer meet the criteria for commitment. It's a very sensible approach to this, and it only requires the basic application of general principles of statutory construction to reach that conclusion. If there aren't any other questions, let me just say this. I wanted to ask the court if there were any questions dealing with the third issue having to do with the additional orders found by the district court in this case.
I had a question on that. The objection is incomplete, but the objection, there is in the objection, the context of the argument here seems to have come close to advising the court what the problem is, but the court interrupts. And then there's not a completion of that. It seems to me your argument is sort of the inherent power kind of issue of the trial court, but it bothers me on the acquittal issue and what the process is going through here, whether or not a district court, I don't think the court has the inherent power to place conditions of probation on someone who's been institutionally committed. So do you have any other argument besides inherent power on that point?
Well, the inherent power argument hinges on the authority of the court to order these patients to undergo treatment. And it's in the context of the level of violence and level of mental illness that we've been talking about.
But the statute says that the judge can suggest that you not drink alcohol or not smoke, but the judge can't order them not to drink alcohol, not smoke. How can the judge order them not to talk to their mom or their sister or something?
It's the state's position that the same kind of separation that we've been talking about between the Health and Safety Code and Article 4603 really applies in this context as well. One example of why that is the case, if there is a commitment purely under the Health and Safety Code, a patient cannot be medicated against their will unless there are certain additional hearings and hoops that are jumped through to get there. That's not the case for an Article 4603. A person who's committed under Article 4603, they can be required to undergo a mandatory medication. So there's a difference in the way you treat people who come from Article 4603 even after the acquittal process. Additionally, I think this is directly answering your question. The authority under 4603 is to ensure that the patients are treated. Now, there's an interest on the part of the patient himself, as well as a part of society, that he actually follow his treatment, and also that the hospital treat him appropriately. To give the court that kind of authority, it seems to me that it isn't much of a stretch to say that the court has to have the authority to issue the kinds of orders to make sure he undergoes that treatment.
So your position is under the Code of Criminal Procedure, 46.03, there is within that scheme the authority of the criminal district court to impose certain conditions of the treatment that are not simply the assignment to the hospital, but really the court retains some sort of authority to impose additional conditions like this, where regardless of what the doctors say, I'm just telling you there are certain people you can't talk to.
That's correct. And well, Article 4603 does specifically and expressly vest the trial court with the ability to disagree with the treating physicians. I mean, even on the issue of release, if the trial court or the jury in the trial court.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Leiden, I want to follow up on my question about the objection. It does look like the attorney at the trial was attempting to get before the judge the concern about these additional conditions that the judge is imposing on Mr. Campbell, but the judge interrupts, and I could not find where the lawyer came back to the objection. And in the context of how it's being briefed up here, you can kind of see what the point was, but if I wasn't familiar with the briefing up here, I'm not sure if I was a trial judge, I would have understood that the objection was to imposing additional conditions as a part of the commitment to the institution was the objection. Can you help me understand how the judge would have necessarily known what that objection was?
All I can say to that, Your Honor, is being in those situations before when you're trying to make an objection saying, Judge, you can't do that. And the judge responds with, well, he may have read the law, but I want him to know what my order is. And the judge stops you from going any further on that. If the judge isn't going to let you finish specifically saying what you're saying, I mean, I think we have to assume the judge knew what your objection was and was overruling that objection. And the judge certainly should have known what the mental health code said at that point.
Would you agree with me, but for interrupting, but for this interruption, it is not exactly clear for someone who's just objectively reading this that they would have known what that objection was.
You can certainly see it that way. I just make one comment about going back to the first issue, then I'll stick with the third issue. The state's public policy reasons for protecting society are no different today than they were for the last 20 years. They have been protecting pursuant to utilizing the mental health code in conjunction with 4603. Just as Mr. Keating stated, every case that he looked at, they have been utilizing the requirements of the mental health code and the requirements for getting the two certificates and having them on file at the time of the hearing. The only reason it's different in this case is the state waited to the absolute last minute to file its request to have him examined by doctors pursuant to the mental health code. And when they got those certificates back, one of them didn't say what they thought it was going to say, but they were out of time. The judge was out of time for going any further. The last day was May 31st, and this was May 31st. And that's why we're in the position that we are now. But the state has always complied with the provisions of the Mental Health Code and protected society for the last 20 years. But now, because they're in this situation that they put themselves in this case, they argue that 4603 applies and the inappropriate provisions of the Mental Health Code do not apply.
Mr. Leitner, do you agree with Mr. Keating's position that Section 5 of Part D of 46.03 does provide specific procedures for judicial release of a person who has been committed pursuant to findings originally under 46.03?
I do, Your Honor, because it refers to the Mental Health Code.
I'm sorry?
It refers to conduct the hearing pursuant to the Mental Health Code.
Well, no, but specifically with respect to how a release occurs, do you agree that it provides specific release provisions and procedures to be followed?
Absolutely. Going back to issue number three, where Mr. Keating said that if the on a 4603 patient, he can be ordered to take Thorazine, for example. Well, certainly, if he's going to be ordered to take Thorazine, that's going to come from the doctors at the mental hospital. There is nothing in the code anywhere that would say, have the judge say, well, I order you to take Thorazine. That was part of our complaint in this situation. This is a patient in a mental hospital who is there for the purpose of being treated. The federal statute that I cited that gives a Bill of Rights to mentally ill individuals and the Mental Health Code both give all of these that it has to be a least appropriate in the least restrictive environment, and they have all these freedom of association and everything else, unless it interferes with their treatment. If it interferes with their treatment, the doctors have a right to put those limitations on him. But this was a situation where the judge put all these limitations on this individual when there's no medical evidence before the judge that says that's necessary for the individual's treatment. It, in fact, was a punitive measure on the part of the judge. There was nothing more from the mental hospital who had been treating him for 6 months other than a question to the court. What do these orders mean? When the judge responded back with these orders that it means no female can be anywhere near him from the staff or from his family, which obviously was intolerable. Less than 30 days later, she amended that to say those just apply to him. So no longer would the staff be in contempt if they treat a female treats Nathan Campbell, but he would certainly be in contempt if he allows that treatment to happen. And in addition thereto, he can't call his grandmother, he can't receive phone calls, he can't go to smoke breaks. If you're taking an individual who is mentally ill and who is being treated, you can quite logically see that the mental hospital may say, when we're progressing through his treatment, trying to attain a position at some point in time that he's well, that we may need to have co-ed meetings and co-ed classes and see how he functions along with the females in there. The treatment team is denied the ability to do that by this court's order. And what I was saying here is not only does it violate what his basic rights are given to him by the federal statute and the state statute, but it necessarily interferes with the treatment. It is not an implied power of the district court that they can go to the mental hospital and micromanage how the doctors treat that patient. He is still a patient in a mental hospital. Therefore, he is not to be treated as a probationer would be if the court has an individual on probation and can make any term and condition of probation they want to. There's a specific statute in the Code of Criminal Procedure that gives the courts the ability to do that. It is a far stretch of the imagination that says 4603, because you have continuing jurisdiction, gives the same powers to the district court that are given to it in the probation statute.
Any
is
other
that
questions?
Question? Yes, sir?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments for the day, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.